Hello and welcome to our latest edition of In Our Welling Time. Today we're going to be looking at the revolutions of 1848, a year when revolution swept across Europe with remarkable speed. From Paris to Vienna, from the streets of Berlin to the cities of northern Italy, governments were challenged, rulers were forced to concede, and for a moment it seemed as though a new political order might emerge. And yet, within a year, most of these revolutions had failed. Monarchies were restored, constitutions withdrawn, and in Prussia, the offer of a united German crown was dismissed by Frederick William IV as a crown from the gutter. So today, we're asking, why did these revolutions break out so widely and so suddenly? What do they have in common? Why do they ultimately fail? And perhaps most importantly, did they change anything at all? To explore this, I'm joined by Ms. McLeod, Mr. Loosley, and Mr. Joy. Let's start with the question, why had liberalism and nationalism grown by 1848? Mr. Loosley.
Right, well, I think the straightforward answer is that they grew because revolutionary ideas had spread since the French Revolution of 1789, and that attempts to repress it had failed. Now, I'd like to unpack that a little bit. Why would the French Revolution lead to the growth of liberal and nationalist ideas? Well, one part of that is the way in which the French Revolution was associated with ideas of the of a constitution, of civil rights for citizens, and the idea of popular sovereignty, that the people, to an extent, should claim some right to rule over monarchs. Now, these liberal ideas, key in the French Revolution of 1789, we then see that they raise their head in the period between 1789 and 1848. So in 1830, another French king, Charles X, is overthrown. And then, as we'll see, the revolutions of 1848 are marked by attacks by liberals on monarchs and their right to rule. So there's a pattern of expectation and rising demands for liberal ideas to be respected by conservative monarchs. In addition to the French Revolution, we've also got the impact of Napoleonic rule in Europe. Now, Napoleon had taken control of a vast swathes of Europe. And in the countries that he had controlled, he introduced reforms which for their time were seen as very liberal and modernizing. The Napoleonic Code, for instance, embedded principles of legal equality and an end to feudal privilege. But at the same time, occupation by French forces provoked nationalist sentiment in places such as Germany and Italy. And in the campaign to push the French back, we see moments where peoples who spoke the same language and share the same national identity, but were not necessarily in the same country, such as the different German people of the various German states, combining together to push back the French. And in the Battle of Leipzig in 1813 is a good example of the, kind of a sense of national unity emerging out of the struggle to defeat the French. So at the same time, while French occupation provoked nationalism, Napoleon also, in the way in which he reorganized Italian states and German states, created kind of a benchmark or model by which they might be united in time. So, for instance, in Italy, Napoleon kind of combined a number of states into a kind of kingdom of Italy. And while after defeat Napoleon, those were fragmented, nevertheless, they made it clear to Italians that it was possible to unite, to come together. And the same principle applied in Germany, where he had combined a number of different German states. So Napoleon is both a reason for nationalism to emerge because he provokes it, but also he encourages it inadvertently by unifying Italian-German states, if only for a time. So that's where these liberal and nationalist ideas are coming from. I mentioned that attempts to repress them fail, and that's largely a combination of the Congress of Vienna in 1815, which sought to turn the clock back by restoring many old regimes, bringing back the French monarchy, for instance, breaking up these Napoleonic countries in Germany and Italy that he had created. And that turning the clock back provokes a backlash amongst people who actually saw something they wanted to keep something from the Napoleonic years. And attempts to push for more liberal reforms, or push for kind of a respect for nationalism or indeed unity, provokes a backlash by Metternich, the kind of chief European statesman of the period. And the Metternich system, which is used in the Austrian Empire and also in Germany, is characterized by censorship, the use of spies, and the suppression of universities where national and liberal ideas are particularly popular. However, despite these attempts, these ideas continue to survive, and we see student groups like the Burschenschaft in the German states, or secret societies like the Carbonari in Italy, still pushing for liberal and nationalist change. So I guess the key point really there is that while Metternich's repression is very successful in containing liberal and nationalist opposition, it fails to remove it.
It's also worth pointing out that actually this has also been driven by a growth of the middle classes across Europe as well. So we've got across the European states rising industrialization, a larger, more aware, politically aware middle class, which had been given some limited political representation in parts of Europe, especially in France, and indeed in the German Confederation through the Frankfurt Diet. So you've got a growing middle class with some hints of political representation, but these are heavily restricted. So you've got an agitated, growing middle class that very much cleave to the ideas of liberalism and nationalism as well.
Yeah, and for sure. I mean, I think that by 1848, the middle class in many across Europe, in France, Germany, Italy, what have you, are increasingly identifying, aren't they, with liberal and nationalist ideas. And I suppose for these to have an impact, what they need is for the conservative regimes that have been blocking it to lose their nerve or be weakened so that then these ideas can be implemented.
Thank you very much for that introduction and looking at the causes of these revolutions in a sort of more the long term and sort of the ideology of the liberalism and nationalism. But let's look at a little bit more short term and trigger now with Mr. MacLeod. Why were there so many revolutions in 1848? What was the kind of the context of them?
So there is a general Europe-wide crisis which applies to all of the countries in our course. And this is one of the key similarities between the revolutions, if you're asked a question about the differences and similarities. Across Europe in the years 1845 to 1847, there is a universally an agricultural crisis. 1845, we see the complete catastrophe of a potato blight, which sweeps through Europe. And, you know, although most famous in Ireland, it affects all of mainland Europe, continent-wide. It's followed the next year by a continent-wide drought. And the result of the failure of these harvests means that the rise in food prices is astronomical. You have the price of wheat rising by 52% in Hamburg between 1841 and 47. But you've also got a human tragedy here as well, because the number of people dying of hunger rises hugely across Europe. It coincides with and leads to a crisis of demand as well in the industrial economy, because of course people now are spending all their money on food. They don't have any spare money in their pockets to buy goods, and so we see production in the industrialized economies also falling. So, example in France, production of iron and coal fell by 30% and 20% respectively in 1847. The result of that is huge levels of unemployment, which only makes the economic crisis that much worse. And of course, it extends this crisis. This is not just a crisis of peasantry or working class. This is a middle class crisis. It's an upper class. It is a crisis that affects every social class. That's the reason that we've got to 1848, which is this is a real crunch point for the whole of Europe.
And that seems to be really important because the middle classes have ideas which threaten the conservative regime, but they don't have the numbers to be a real threat. And actually, why is it that things break out in 1848? It's this combination of political ideas, which have been kind of bubbling along for the last 20, 30 years, combined with a real threat from all these angry and violent lower classes. And when those protests combine with the political ideas is when we start to see revolution brewing.
Oh, and yeah, so absolutely, you're absolutely right. And of course, what happens now, we've got basically a powder keg. We've got a powder keg within Europe. And actually what now happens, this is the crucial thing, is you now have like a house of cards. Once one of the cards gets falls over, so the whole European revolutions begin to spread. So once we start to see this happening in Paris, we just have copycat revolutions happening elsewhere. So it is the reason they happen at the same time is because of the concurrency, the fact that all these crises happen at the same time, but also because once it happens in one place, so it will spread, you know, like a disease across Europe very, very rapidly.
And that's a real key feature of the 1848 revolutions. We've mentioned there's been revolutions beforehand, but they haven't really ever spread. But 1848, what's really distinctive is the way in which revolution in France quickly leads to revolution in Austria, the fall of Metternich leads to revolution in Berlin, and also leads to revolution in Milan. And suddenly what we've got is rather than just one revolution, we've got this very distinctive feature of 1848, which is a European-wide upsurge revolution, with each revolution kind of having impact on the next.
And even going all the way to Sicily, sort of where it all starts in sort of January, February 1848 with the overthrow of, well, he gives a constitution, doesn't he? The Bourbon king of Naples.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's right.
Okay, thank you. So we have looked at that, the sort of the short term there, the economic crisis, and then the domino effect, if you like, of these two issues. And this makes these revolutions spread, but also quite uniquely spread. But let's go turn now to Mr. Joy. What did these revolutions have in common, if anything at all?
Well, the short answer is, and to borrow from my favourite historian on the topic, Christopher Clark, they follow a pretty consistent pattern. And this seems to repeat itself almost mechanically across four different countries that we can now turn our attention to. So, in short order, in Vienna, Metternich's removed, Berlin, we've got the king promising constitution. And then in France, the monarchy is abolished. And this creates the impression, at least, that the revolution is indeed working. I would emphasize here the speed of this. So Louis-Philippe falls in 3 days. Metternich, the architect, as we've already heard, of the Metternich system, that repressive conservatism that is embedded through Europe against the force of liberalism, the entire post-Napoleonic order there, dominant for decades, it's gone within hours of the emperor losing his nerve on the 13th of March. So governments don't concede a little, they concede everything. And Ferdinand of Austria, he even grants universal male suffrage for a constituent assembly in May 1848. Added to this, we've got broad but ultimately unstable alliances amongst the liberals who are looking for political reform, i.e. they want rights, they want representation, they want parliamentary or partial parliamentary democracy. And then the radicals who are representing the workers, who are under particular strain, as we've heard, in terms of their economic and social and unemployment issues they're facing, which are really acute. So they are after social and economic reform. I would add into this mix, if we look at the Frankfurt Parliament in Germany, for example, that's elected on universal male suffrage, yet it is dominated almost entirely by lawyers, by professors, by officials. We have 831 middle-class deputies far more interested in national unification than wages or working hours. So that's just designed to illustrate to you, the listener, that there are competing demands here. And it's that lack of unity underneath the surface here that we need to be aware of, because it is all important. I'd also turn our attention to thinking about France. So Lamartine then has created the national workshops, but he stripped Louis Blanc of real power by placing those national workshops under the Ministry of Public Works. So the concession is designed to look like reform, while actually under the surface, it's a half measure. It doesn't really fool anybody. And that unity, or lack of unity rather, is actually pretty significant. So do look at that further. Thirdly, I think we should turn our attention to thinking about the similar demands that are there across Europe. The common demands are constitutions, representative democracy in the shape of representative government, and then national unity as well. In the German states, so the Frankfurt Parliament attempts to create a unified Germany. In Italy, uprisings are aimed at ending Austrian dominance. There's an interesting texture here as well in terms of the economics. So political demands run in parallel, it seems, with very concrete demands. So food security, minimum wages, price controls, the right to work, they all emerge from the 45-47 crises. In Switzerland, to illustrate, rye prices, so to replace kind of your standard bread, they double between 45 and 47. So these are real, real concerns. In Hamburg, wheat rises by 52%. And then in France, a third of the working population of Paris, which is a staggering figure, they were being supported by charity actively by 1847. So the Frankfurt Parliament's failure to engage, for example, with any of that is one of the clearest reasons why it collapses. If you're going to offer people freedom, are they going to choose bread or its equivalent, or are they going to actually prioritise rights in a parliament? These things are very powerful. Fourthly, I think we should examine the rapid breakdown of unity. So in France, we've got the June days, very dramatic, of 1848, where the government crush the workers' uprising. And then in the German states, we have divisions over Greater Germany versus that Lesser Germany, or this Kleindeutsch or smaller German solution. And then in Italy, we've got a lack of coordination between the various states.
Thank you very much. So we've got many similarities there are many commonalities. Anyone want to comment on any differences between these revolutions?
Yeah, sure. So there are, as we've seen, there's this this pattern across the revolutions. But it's also interesting to consider how they differ. I think one clear difference thing is where nationalism is really playing a role. So, for instance, in France, nationalism is not a feature of the revolution because the country is a united country already. Its ruler is French. There's no real nationalist angle to what the revolutionaries want in France. What they want is liberal reform or help for workers, as Mr. Joyce outlined. And obviously, that's a clear difference between the revolutions in Germany, which many nationalists want to have unity. In Italy, where there's a kind of two lines of thinking, one is a unified Italy, or at least an Italy which governs itself and is not dominated by foreign rulers such as the Austrians. And then in Austria, you've got this kind of Austrian Empire, you've got this diverse or this varied attitude towards nationalist autonomy. You know, some ethnic minorities within Austria want simply autonomy and recognition. But then you do have the Hungarians, who increasingly are pushing for actual independence. So there's one clear difference, I think, between the French Revolution, at least, and the revolutions happening elsewhere across the continent.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned Austria. We haven't had, Hungary, rather. We haven't had Hungary yet. So,
and that's perhaps another difference I'd pick up on, which is, I think, one interesting thing is that in Hungary, nationalism actually isn't merely a middle-class concern. Actually, nationalism has reached the kind of peasants and the people as a whole. Whereas I think in Germany and Italy, nationalism is still very much, particularly like German nationalism, rather than just simply nationalism of being a Prussian or being from Württemberg. The kind of a wider German nationalism hasn't really gone beyond the middle class. And I think the same thing is true in Italy. But in Hungary, we've got this very special case where nationalism really does spread across the social spectrum from rich to poor.
Great. Thank you very much. We now come to our fourth question, which is why did these revolutions fail? And I'll go back to you, Mr. Loosley. What are the reasons you've identified there for that?
Okay, well, again, as with what we've just been talking about there, I suppose, there are similarities and differences. Now, if there's some general, as part of the kind of the general pattern that Mr. Joy has outlined, one thing that we already had explained are the divisions within the revolutionaries and the way in which, at first, they appear united and kind of working together, but the kind of liberals, the more radical liberals, and the kind of with the workers. But those fault lines quickly emerge. And Mr. Joy's already outlined the Frankfurt Parliament's failure to deal with socioeconomic concerns, or the way in which the French government, which let's not forget was democratically elected and kind of you might see it as a liberal government, nevertheless using force to crush the workers in the June days. So those basically those divisions allow a conservative counter-revolution to divide the revolutionaries between themselves. And we see revolutionaries not supporting each other in the face of conservative repression. Okay, and indeed, actually, sometimes allying themselves with conservative violence. We mentioned ones about liberals. There's other ones about nationalists, for instance. So you know, the kind of German nationalists don't see it as their business to support the nationalist claims of minority groups in Austria, for instance, and they resent or they reject Czech nationalist demands because they infringe upon what they see as German national demands. So we see nationalists falling out amongst themselves. So that's one key reason why they fail. I mean, I think perhaps another reason really that I would say is perhaps more important is just the way in which the conservatives maintain ultimately the monopoly of force. They are the ones who are able to draw upon the army. They maintain the loyalty of the army, generally speaking. And once they have once they've regained their nerve and they've started to see the way in which revolutionaries are falling out amongst themselves, they show no hesitation to use violence to crush revolution. And we see that again and again and again. We've mentioned the June days in Paris. There is the crushing of the kind of the Czech revolt in Prague. Later on, we'll see force used to restore order in Berlin. We have an uprising in Vienna crushed by Windischgrat. We have violence, Austrian violence against Italian nationalists in Italy. And ultimately, perhaps the revolution which appears to achieve so much at first, the Hungarian Revolution, which actually gets so far as to kind of lay claim to real genuine independence, ultimately is defeated by a combination of Austrian force and Russian intervention. So there's a kind of clear pattern that actually there's the revolutions fail, yes, because there's divisions, but I would say more importantly, because conservative governments can maintain the loyalty of their armies and they use that to crush revolution across the continent.
Thank you. I might come to Mr. McLeod in a moment about kind of what he thinks was the main reason why they failed. But Mr. Joy, is there anything extra that you could add to what Mr. Loosley said about why these revolutions failed?
I would just like to sort of reinforce and provide like a visual image for the students listening. Historians have thought about this in terms of squares and towers. If you think about sort of radicals and again middle class liberals, they are the squares. That as in they are flat, and they yes they might be solid, but their resourcing is nothing like the conservative forces. So they have armies, they have significant land and finance to tap into, and they have that tradition as well in terms of leadership. So the towers, the conservative forces acting against those squares. That's a nice visual image, I think, for students to think about. But that's just to reinforce what Mr. Loosley has already said really clearly.
Let's move on.
To add to that a little bit as well, the idea as well, I think we've already talked about the split in the revolutionaries, especially between a sort of a middle class liberal and a sort of a more working class radical traditions that we saw united briefly in the spring of 1848. One of the other reasons it splits, and it splits for perhaps slightly different reasons in different places, but one of the reasons it does is we see that unity, the revolutions become very quickly urban, and they don't really engage with rural peasantry in any real meaningful way. Peasantry do bring their concerns to the various bodies within the European states, but they are generally ignored. And actually quite quickly, the conservative powers realised that actually those kind of that peasantry, the rural peasantry, are actually more conventionally supportive of the conservative forces than they are of a middle class liberal elite that is based in cities. And actually, there's a very traditional loyalty that actually the conservative forces can draw upon. In Austria, within Hungary and within the Austrian Empire, once they've got rid of feudalism, well, that's all the peasants really wanted. So they were quite happy to sort of sit back and become politically inactive and not supportive of any kind of nationalist projects, which, as far as they're concerned, had nothing to do with them in the first place. Meanwhile, in France, the middle classes are terrified of working classes because they know what happens when radicals take over, because in the French Revolution, that had led to the Great Terror. And, you know, lots of middle classes would end up being killed in the streets. So there is the peasantry actually turn out to be a much more conservative force than the conservatives realise, the rulers realise, and actually they realise they can pull on the resources and call on the support of the working classes and the peasantry within their regions.
And then the elites co-opting broad support from the lower classes for the national project as well. So nationalism is like an ideological chameleon that is then manipulated through this learning experience of the conservatives. And rather powerfully in terms of shaping forces, as we see in our other course in German unification.
Yeah.
That is so apparent.
And I think the conservatives learn a really powerful lesson in that actually the lower classes are not a class to be afraid of. I think they, 1848, they are afraid of them. And you can see that when they run away, how quickly they are willing to give up power because they are so afraid of the mass of the working people. But actually, 1848 teaches them a lesson that actually these very people that they were scared of initially are the people actually they can depend on.
And I think it's also worth considering, I mean, we've been talking about reasons for failure. Is there a side of this which, how likely was success in the first place with these liberal ideas, nationalist ideas, for instance? And we talked about how liberal ideas were really largely middle class, and we hear how actually the vast majority of the population is rural, and they are uninterested in liberal reform, and ditto when it comes to nationalist ideas. And when we think about how revolution fails in Germany, there's a sense, I think, that when it comes to the Frankfurt Parliament, that really the idea that an elected assembly of idealistic middle-class Germans is somehow going to unite all these different German kingdoms into one in the face of the opposition of the princes themselves that govern the kingdoms, who also have the army. You have to ask a question, when the Prussians use troops to sweep away the Frankfurt Parliament, it's largely already kind of gone nowhere anyway. And the kind of the futile nature of this idealistic vision of if we sit in an assembly and talk about it, we can unite Germany, is kind of exposed when they offer the crown to Frederick William IV, who then is like, well, thanks, but no thanks, and was never really ever going to accept it anyway. So there's a slight sense, but when you get to the end of 1848, looking back at it with hindsight, was there really a meaningful chance that these, idealistic goals could be implemented in that time and place? I mean, it's Bismarck himself who says later, right, that that these kind of big questions are not going to be resolved by majority decisions and people discussing things in a room, but by blood and iron. And so maybe the entire method of revolutionaries in 1848 is never going to work.
Well, thank you. That leads on quite well to our last question, which is, it sounds like these revolutionaries were total failures. There, nothing changed and so on. But Mr. Joy, do you want to sort of tell us a bit about it? Did the revolutions actually change anything?
So yes, they certainly did in the longer term. In the short term, it looks like failure. So in the short term, we have the suppression of the revolutions. We've heard a little bit about this already. Constitutions are withdrawn or they're not actually fully instituted themselves, and old rulers are restored. In Austria, we have the control there regained by conservative forces and by the monarchy in Italy and Vienna with some assistance. And then we have in Prussia the reassertion of, again, royal authority. So just add to that, that the nature of this, it's comprehensive. Austria, Emperor Franz Josef, he felt confident enough in 1851 to discard the constitution entirely, and he reinstituted, again, absolutism. And then in France, Louis Napoleon went further. By December of 1852, he had declared himself, perhaps inspired by another Napoleon predecessor, Emperor Napoleon III. So really, that is the final death knell for all of the aims of the 1848 revolution. So short term, this looks pretty categorical. It looks like significant failure. However, we do have the collapse of the Metternich system to reference. So Metternich's forced into exile, March of 1848. His system of repression and sort of heavy conservatism that is never fully restored. But Metternich's not just a politician. He is the sort of the ideological guarantor of the post-1815 conservatism that was in direct conflict with the liberalism of the French Revolution across the whole continent. So with that, that gives encouragement to revolutionaries across continents. And that doesn't die. We have these movements, Young Italy, Young Ireland, young groups who are really thinking about the future and are actually inspired through the events of 48 and feel a sense of common connection. And so their goals don't necessarily shift. Crucially, though, Metternich isn't replaced with an equivalent system. So that old rigid framework where we have heavy censorship, secret policing, and then coordinated conservative conferences, that doesn't reconstruct or reconstitute itself. Conservatives, after 48, they have to find a new way of governing. And they found that in nationalism. And that involves a different set of sort of values, principles, and sort of political operation and interaction with society. Another and perhaps a final consideration is the strengthening here of nationalism. So the failure of 48, certainly in that short term, that leads to more pragmatic approaches in terms of Germany. We have unification, which is later achieved, as we've already heard, through blood and iron under Bismarck. It's not liberal revolution. And in Italy, nationalism continues to eventual unification in the 1860s. I think this is really interesting because we have a long-term argument and keen to bring in, of course, others into this. So Trevelyan's famous line of about 1848, the turning point at which modern history failed to turn, is probably worth thinking about that and then challenging this. Christopher Clark, again, he argues that 48 fundamentally changed the character of nationalism. Before 48, nationalism was a liberal force and it was tied to constitutions and popular sovereignty. But after 1848, conservative leaders such as Bismarck, but especially perhaps Bismarck, realised that they can harness nationalism, as we've heard a little bit already about, to strengthen the state rather than to challenge it. And we can be pretty direct, I think, and I'm interested in what others feel. In 48, that's the date where nationalism changed from being a liberal force to being a force, in fact, for conservatism. So I'll pause there. I'm keen to hear from others. Have I oversimplified? Is there other angles there to consider?
No, I mean I totally agree. I think that's the key outcome is this shift of nationalism as a sort of middle class liberal idea to a force which the conservative elites lean very much into. And I think the key lesson that they learn from the 1848 revolutions is that actually it's not enough to be reactionary. You know, post 1815, they're trying to suppress ideas, suppress people, but they realise that's a game that is not worth playing, and it's also actually a game they can play themselves and be successful in. Hence why I totally agree with Mr. Joy that they equip themselves with nationalism, and nationalism becomes a key weapon in their armory as they, you know, move forward into the late 19th century.
And I think it's worth revisiting the idea about political change and whether much is achieved politically. I mean, I think I wouldn't disagree with the idea that the 1848 revolutions clearly failed to achieve much of what they hoped to achieve. And if we're talking about change through the prism of like success, clearly many revolutionaries see the 1848 revolution as a failure because they have this high point early on in spring 1848 where they seem to have achieved so much. And yet all those achievements, or many of them, are reversed or retreat. There are a couple of things that are achieved and which stay. So just to acknowledge those, I suppose, the Statuto in Piedmont, this constitution that's granted by Charles Albert, is not withdrawn and ultimately will become the constitution for United Italy. And in fact, it still features in the Italian constitution today, if we can bring it up to the present day. Also in the German states and in the Austrian Empire, there's quite a dramatic, though often kind of... an often sort of ignored change, I suppose, of the change to feudal obligations in the countryside and the kind of obligation called robot in Austrian Empire, whereby peasants were required to work a certain number of days on the kind of land of the nearby landowner or gentry. That doesn't necessarily feel like a very big change, but I guess if we think about the impact upon the lives of everyday people at the time, no longer having to work on the local feudal overlord's land throughout your entire life. I think there's a claim to be made that's actually a very dramatic change in the lives of a huge number of people in the German Empire and in the German state, and in the Austrian Empire. But often overlooked by the big political conflict that we've been discussing.
Thank you. I think coming to an end on this podcast on the revolutions of 1848, and they represent something of a bit of a paradox. In the short term, they failed decisively. Across Vienna, Berlin, and much of the Italian states, revolutionary gains were reversed. Armies reasserted control, and the old order returned with surprising resilience. And yet, it would be misleading to see 1848 simply as a failure. The collapse of the Metternich system, as we've discussed, the persistence of nationalist ambitions in Germany and Italy. And remember that Italy was united well within about 15 years of this event. And the growing expectation of constitutional government all point to something more enduring. The ideas that drove these revolutions, liberalism, nationalism and representation, were not defeated. They were just deferred or delayed. Perhaps then 1848 is best understood not as a turning point that immediately transforms Europe, but as a moment that revealed both the power of the political ideas and the limits of revolution without unity, leadership and control of force. My thanks to our panel, Mr. McLeod, Mr. Loosley and Mr. Joy. This is Mr. Guthridge ending this our podcast on the 1848 revolutions. Thanks for listening.